It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Pixar's new movie, Finding Dory, hits theaters this week. In the movie, Dory, as played by Ellen DeGeneres, is a loving but forgetful fish friend. Here is a moment between Dory and Marlin, Nemo's dad, from the movie Finding Nemo.
Hey, Mr. Grumpy Gills. When life gets you down, you know what you gotta do?
I don't wanna know what you gotta do.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim, swim.
Dory, no singing.
Dory. I love to swim in.
Dory.
When you want to swim, you want
See,
to
See, I'm gonna get stuck now with that song. Now it's in my head.
Sorry.
In addition to being funny and sweet, Dory is also beautiful. She is a Pacific blue tang. And just like sales of clownfish skyrocketed after the first movie, pet stores are anticipating demand for Pacific blue tangs. But that could have even more serious consequences for a fish that cannot be bred in captivity. To talk with me about how animals are portrayed on screen and the real-world consequences for the animals portrayed in very popular movies and on TV shows are Jason Goldman. He's a science journalist based in Los Angeles. Hello, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. Also with us today, Mick McAuliffe, Animal Services Manager for the Animal Rescue League of Des Moines. Hello, Mick.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
And Jason, since we're starting with Dory, the Pacific blue tang, let's talk a little bit about this fish. What do we know about this species?
Well, in the wild, they come from sort of the coral reefs of the Indo-Pacific, and they actually perform a really important service for these coral reefs. Corals are sort of defined by this relationship between the actual coral animals and the algae that live inside of them, and those algae need light to photosynthesize. And what these blue tangs do is they prevent other algae from growing over the coral, blocking out the light. So you can imagine if there were suddenly a world deprived of these blue tangs that ate up all that coral, the reefs would pretty quickly be overgrown by algae and could die, could become bleached, and it could pretty quickly sort of topple the entire reef ecosystem.
Well, and of course it is a very beautiful fish. I was surprised to learn that it can't be bred in a tank. I mean, the clownfish, people anticipated, pet store owners anticipated, breeders anticipated that clownfish were going to become very popular after Finding Nemo came out. They were absolutely right about that. And they were breeding clownfish for sale, although these are also wild fish, but at least can be bred in an aquarium. With the Pacific blue tangs, they actually have to be caught in the wild, right?
Yeah. There are many researchers who have been working on trying to figure out how to breed them in aquaculture, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult for any sort of creature, but we're definitely not there yet with this species for certain.
Well, and Mick, I want to bring you into the conversation. I realize that the Animal Rescue League, that people don't often surrender fish to you, but many people do surrender many other kinds of animals. And I know that this is something that troubles you a great deal. But with these fish, when a fish suddenly rises in popularity, I mean, we actually, with the clownfish, not only are they difficult to take care of, you've got to have a saltwater tank. There's a lot of upkeep that goes into that. But also, because kids were inspired by the movie, there were actually kids who were flushing fish down the toilet in an effort to release them, right?
Yeah, and that's not what we want from anybody, to do anything with animals like that. We see a rise in when movies come out. Unfortunately, we don't get a lot of fish. I always wonder where they end up, because they're not your average pet, and all pets and, you know, ownership needs to be researched, and you're right. The difficulty of owning these exotics and saltwater fish is much, much higher than people, you know, expect. And then they end up either in a shelter or, unfortunately, down the toilet.
Well, and I was doing some reading, Jason, about turtles. Apparently, pet turtles really rose in popularity I guess, have every time one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies are released. And the statistics about what happens to those turtles are really sad, really scary, in fact. Can you tell me a little bit about what we know about that phenomenon?
You can almost just, at this point, you can just predict that if a popular movie comes out featuring an animal, there will be an associated rise in the pet trade. So the Ninja Turtles movies, pretty much all of them over the years, have led to increased sales in pet turtles. Particularly, we see a lot of red-eared slider turtles, which end up becoming, in some ecosystems, very invasive when they get released, either intentionally or accidentally. There are so many different overlapping concerns when we think about the pet trade. There are conservation concerns, there are animal welfare concerns, but then there's also concerns about invasive species, which I think for these turtles is probably one of the main problems.
Well, and let's visit a sort of cautionary tale. This is one that takes us back to the 1970s, and actually a really beautiful, beautiful memoir that was written by Sterling North, called Rascal, about a pet raccoon that he kept as a child during World War One. And that memoir was turned into a movie by Disney. And I didn't know this. It was also turned into an animated series in Japan. And of course, it is not legal to keep wild animals as pets, but that was a long time ago. And in the book, he also realizes that his raccoon is not an animal that can be kept humanely as a pet. He releases it into the wild. But tell me what happened in Japan when the story of this lovable raccoon got turned into an animated series.
Right. So in the story, the boy, Sterling North, adopts an orphaned raccoon and, raises it from childhood. And as the series aired in Japan, understandably, lots of children ended up wanting raccoons as pets, which is by now a pattern that we know well. And raccoons are certainly not native to Japan, and they're definitely not suitable pets. So a lot of these pet raccoons end up escaping because they're not pets. But also, what happens is at the end of the story, when Sterling North decides to release his raccoon friend back into the woods, some of the Japanese children decided that they too needed to release their pet raccoons back into the woods. Unfortunately, these are not woods that that had evolved to be able to sustain raccoon populations. So the result is by now. Now it's some 40, 50 years later. Raccoons are in something like 42 out of 47 Japanese prefectures. They are really important agricultural pests. They edge out many important native species, especially some of the endangered and threatened ones. And they also seem to have a habit of getting into some very ancient buildings, old temples and things like that, and doing some pretty important damage to some of these irreplaceable structures when they get into the attics and things like that. So it's a real problem, and it's not like you can press the pause button or rewind to a time before there were raccoons there. Even if you could, find all the raccoons in the Japanese countryside and cull them all, there's not really good public support for that kind of wildlife control measure.
So when you're talking about these turtles possibly being released into the wild in the United States, it could be a very similar kind of circumstance. And it's kind of interesting to think about. We have a number of birds that are invasive species, and this goes back a long time to somebody who wanted to introduce all of the birds that were mentioned in Shakespeare plays into the United States, and that's where some of our most invasive species of birds come from. So this is a phenomenon that's been going on a long time where people want to take fiction and turn it into reality.
Absolutely. And it's not just turtles, it's not just birds. You know, here in California, we have one of the most, or at least in L.A., one of the most common squirrels you see is the eastern fox squirrel. Clearly, L.A. is not a place where you find an animal called eastern. So, you know, anywhere humans go, we're going to bring species with us. But we could also perhaps try to think deliberately and carefully about whether and how we might try to avoid making things even worse than they already are.
Well, and of course, it's not just wild animals. It's not just possible invasive species. I mean, Mick, every time there is a movie that features a specific breed of dog, for example, you see a big jump in that kind of dog that's been surrendered. I mean, can you give us an example of one of those phenomenons you've witnessed in the past?
Yeah, well, one of the biggest one that comes to mind was 101 Dalmatians. A little while ago, but each time that movie's redone, and it's not immediate. We see that it could be up to a year later where the cute little whatever movie that been in, that animal or dog has been in, and people rush out on the, you know, movies are made to be entertainment and evoke emotion, which it does, and it brings back good feelings when you see that little puppy, but that puppy turns into a large adult, and unfortunately, due to the high demand, there's, how would I put it, not good breeding that happens. I'm not saying all breeders, I'm just saying there's people out there that then try and cash in on the market and don't breed for temperament or structure, and therefore we end up with sick or behaviorally unsound dogs, and of course people then lose the interest and they end up in the shelter.
Well, and there's another element to that as well that we'll talk about in just a moment. We're talking about how animals are portrayed on screen and some of the real life consequences that come to be because of those portrayals. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. With me this hour, Mick McAuliffe, Animal Services Manager for the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines, and Jason Goldman, science journalist based in Los Angeles. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Behind the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms, I'll go sailing. It's far beyond the stars, it's near beyond the moon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about how animals are portrayed in film and some of the real-world consequences that can have. We have been talking about the new movie coming out, Finding Dory, and the fact that people are anticipating an increase in people buying Pacific blue tang fish that cannot be bred in captivity. And there are a lot of conservationists concerned about what that could mean for the species. But we're also talking about other phenomena that have occurred in the past. With me, Mick McAuliffe, Animal Services Manager for the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines, and Jason Goldman, science journalist. He's based in Los Angeles. And Mick, before the break, we were talking about 101 Dalmatians and how a lot of people went out and got Dalmatian puppies. And you were talking about the fact that given there was so much demand, there was some unethical breeding probably going on, which resulted in sick dogs or dogs with behavioral issues because they weren't being bred for temperament, etc. But does it go beyond that? Because, of course, a lot of animals get surrendered all the time. There are a lot of Dalmatians that are really, really great pets. Is it also part of the thought process that did or did not go into that adoption or that purchase that results in this crisis?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. No matter what, whether it be a kitten, a cat, a fish, a turtle, because we have lots of turtles, we definitely got our share after the Ninja movies. Is the research and educating your public, educating themselves in what the long term is. You have exotics, I own parrots, and I have to make sure that I have, in my will, I've made placement and finances for them because they may outlive me because I have two large parrots. So doing your research, the commitment and care, and actually know what you're getting yourself in for and what to look for in the future and how to make sure these animals are both medically and behaviorally well cared for.
When adoptions happen, of course, there is a certain element of serendipity or a certain element of impulse, because when you decide that you want to adopt a dog, you go to the animal shelter or wherever you choose to go and you fall in love. So there has to be a little bit of that impulse, right?
Oh, yeah. There's some research or some studies that are showing it happens within 30 seconds. And that's just on a visual and seeing a pet. With the adoption process, we have counselors, we take meet and greet. Our organization here, as well as many others, have lots of support mechanisms in place and resources to provide pet owners as well, prior, during, and after adoption. So it's the bigger picture. Some of the impulse or that, we want to make sure that the public's got that support structure right from the beginning and are educated. And I'm not saying people aren't doing that, but some definitely are not doing that. Not everyone, but we have to make sure we do the right thing by the pets and by the people.
So does this just kind of go along with the campaigns trying to educate people not to buy a pet for a holiday, that kind of thing, to understand that this is a lifelong commitment to an animal, not an adorable present?
Unfortunately, yeah, and we'll never get past the adorable present, which I understand. But if we just take a breath for a moment and, you know, the kids will go to college one day. Where does that animal end up after the kids go to college? Or like me, I moved from another country and didn't know I was going to, but I had to make provisions for my existing pets at that time when I left, you know, Australia. So there's many, many things that you may not think about at the time, but just the fundamentals, general care, enrichment, veterinary care, all those things should be at the forefront. This is wonderful. I feel good about doing this. Am I ready for this?
Well, and of course, a lot of us who've had dogs or cats our whole lives, you know, we understand how big a commitment that is, and and we'll take that plunge willingly. Do you think with some of these other species, it's easier to kind of underestimate the kind of commitment that you're making? A turtle doesn't seem like a very big thing, and if it's in an aquarium, you know, maybe that's not such a big deal. Do you think that that's part of the problem?
Definitely. Without that research, the turtles we get, and definitely we have the red ear sliders, we've had 19 that I know of that we can't release, that we have to find homes for. We have them up for over a year, but they are sold in the pet store as a very small turtle, and we get them up to 6 to 8 inches in shell, you know, or even bigger, because all of a sudden that cute little turtle, and it was really cool to have. They takes a lot to care for, and just at that time, either they weren't educated or it became too much, so they end up in the shelter, which is not where they should be.
You know, talking about the portrayal of animals in film, Jason, it feels to me like there has been a shift in Hollywood over the years. When I think, you know, we were talking about the 1970s and the portrayal of that raccoon and his boy, but also just thinking about how much more accurate most of the bigger films are that show animals. You know, we recently had The Jungle Book, the remade Jungle Book came out, and they recast some of the animals in that film so that they were actually animals that could be, or at least at some point in the space-time continuum, could be native to India. Do you feel like there's progress being made in that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think we see some of those trends. I mean, but it's worth asking what accuracy means when we're talking about, you know, talking anthropomorphized animals that, you know, interact with each other in a way in which they would not in the wild. So yeah, we can talk about accuracy in some ways, but at the end of the day, these are still movies and television shows. These are stories. These are not science documentaries, and I would not argue that it's the job of these filmmakers to teach us science or conservation. It's their jobs to tell us a good story and to entertain us.
At the same time, though, you know, a lot of young people take inspiration. Maybe a lot of adults also take inspiration from these films. I mean, I think about Jurassic Park, and suddenly, you know, people were interested in different kinds of dinosaurs beyond the dinosaurs they'd learned about in first grade. And eventually, you know, a lot of people learned a whole lot about paleontology and dinosaurs. I mean, isn't there something to be said for that kind of process?
Absolutely, absolutely. And my hope would be, you know, if someone is inspired, if someone's imagination is engaged by these movies and TV shows, they should, you know, go out and learn more. But to think that something like Jurassic Park or The Jungle Book or Zootopia or Finding Nemo, Finding Dory is sort of the end of that educational line is, I think, probably not the right way to think about it.
Well, it's interesting to think, though, there have been movies that have really made an effort to study animal behavior, although obviously these animals are anthropomorphized. And one of the examples that is really interesting to talk about, I think, is the movie Up. And people who saw that film know that there is a dog in the film who's thoughts are translated into human speech. I mean, that's the idea anyway. And let's listen to just a small clip from that film.
Did that dog just say hi there?
Oh, yes.
Brad!
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel!
So that's just a moment from the movie Up. And I mean, Jason, as a dog lover, when I saw that movie, I thought, yeah, that really rings true. That certainly feels like what my dogs may be thinking at any given time. And there was some science behind that, too, right?
Well, I actually never saw that movie, so I can't necessarily speak to that in particular. But I don't want to sort of be the wet blanket scientist. But, you know, there's a lot of things that we think are the case about how our pets, the animals with which we're most familiar, you know, our dogs and our cats think and feel, that are not necessarily accurate reflections of their inner states.
All right. Mick, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, other than Up is one of my favorite movies. And when I did see that, I believe Dr. Ian Dunbar was a reference or a consultant on that movie who's a veterinary behaviorist. And, you know, we don't know exactly what dogs think, and we are putting that human emotion, thought, and desire of what we'd maybe like to think. But, again, it's a movie and it's entertaining, and I even do exactly that, sit and watch dogs' behavior and, you know, wonder what they'd say if that was the case.
Well,
it's fun. It's interesting, and it was good fun. It was just a really nice way to look at it.
Well, and Jason, since you've been playing professional wet blanket, let's talk a little bit more about maybe some of the downsides of this kind of anthropomorphization that happens with animals in movies. I mean, we've talked about people adopting pets that they may not be prepared to take care of, or adopting exotic animals that are really wild animals and shouldn't be kept as pets and can even lead to invasive species problems. But does it also, in your opinion, does it sometimes influence how we interact with wildlife?
Yeah. I mean, I think that as a society, in many ways, we're sort of confused about our relationship with other animals and sort of our place in the natural world in relationship with all the other species out there. You know, we keep seeing stories. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, there was the story about the family that put the young bison into their car in Yellowstone. And you know, no matter what you think about the intentions of these folks, and I'm sure that the intentions were good, I think the actions represented a fundamental misunderstanding about how how animals work, and different species have different needs. You know, you see lots and lots of videos being shared online, and cute photos, and gifts, and things like that. And without knowing, without having the expertise to really evaluate what's going on, it's hard to understand exactly what these animals are going through. You know, there are many animals that in the wild are solitary, and if you see an animal, you might think that it needs its family, but for that species, that could not actually be how it is most happy.
Well, and from my perspective, I feel like it doesn't have as much to do with what we see in the media, but how divorced most of us are from nature, which is a problem that's just been growing and growing. So, I mean, for some people, what they see on the screen may be the only real contact they have with wildlife or nature. And that seems to me a different problem than just how animals are portrayed. What do you think about that, Jason?
Well, I think there's something to that, but I also think we have to rethink what we think of as wildlife. You know, not everyone is necessarily going to have the chance to travel to Africa to see lions. You know, not everyone is necessarily going to be able to go to the Amazon jungle to chase after the monkeys. But most of us, even in the most urban environments in our country, there's so much wildlife if you're willing to stop and think about the fact that squirrels and birds and raccoons and coyotes and possums and all of these things are wildlife and are wild animals. And, you know, many of them are used to thinking of as pests, as things that annoy us, at least. But they are wild animals. They are wildlife. And that, I think, in many cases, can be a good way to start thinking about shifting the way we relate to other animals.
Do you feel like there is a lack of people in your profession as a science writer who are getting the word out about actually what facts are about how animals live and the ecosystem we are part of?
I'm not sure. There's certainly a problem in as much as lots of mainstream media outlets, lots of, you know, newspapers and magazines are reducing or eliminating their science sections. I think those science writers we do have usually do a pretty good job of discussing some of these issues. There's just there's not necessarily enough of us.
Well, and Mick, before we run out of time, can you give us a little advice? So if my kid says, "Mom, I want Dory," what kind of thought process should I go through? How should parents approach this?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea that, you know, children are interested and we can develop that, that's our education opportunity, and sit down together and spend the time and do the research and learn about where they come from and how they live naturally, and are they captive bred or not captive bred, and what are we going to do and who's going to care? I think it's a fantastic opportunity, one, to get our younger generation to learn the right way, and a good experience overall.
So when you see people coming in to the shelter to make an adoption, do you ever see danger signs, things that make you think, you know, maybe this hasn't been thought through?
We do. We often, or not often, I should say, but we always sit down with people and explain, because they may see a particular species or breed, a cockatoo, for example, is not your average pet, but they look, you know, I love cockatoos, by the way, one of my favorite birds, but they're not your average pet, and they have different emotional needs. So they go, "Oh, but I want it." Well, that's great, but here's the reality of the situation. And there are times where we will deny an adoption just due to the fact that the person does not want to be educated, and we don't think that's fair on the animal, so we won't let that person adopt for that species.
Well, and I know that even without taking movies into consideration, there are always animals that need to be adopted. Do you have a particularly large number of anything right now?
Always cats, unfortunately. The spay-neuter word has been, it's been a long road, and it's definitely better than what it was. But I do encourage everyone to get, we have such great programs, so do shelters throughout the state and country. Just spay and neuter our pets.
Well, Mick, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mick McAuliffe, Animal Services Manager for the Animal Rescue League in Des Moines. Jason Goldman, thank you.
Thank you.
Jason Goldman, a science journalist based in Los Angeles. We've been talking about animals on screen this hour and how that can translate into some real-world problems. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Old Mother Nature's recipe that brings the bare necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, I could be fonder of my big home. The bees are buzzing in a tree to make some honey just for me. When you look under the rocks and plants, take a glance at them fancy ants and then maybe try a few.